Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of April, coming up on the program. Very much a price and pain-driven program today. Petrol up overnight. Can we drive better? Electricity increases have already kicked in. And why last year was the worst ever for consumer debt and the hardship continues. And also, what happens now to the e-toll gantries now that tolling has been scrapped? It's a double whammy price increase week. Eskom's 12% electricity price increase for the 24-25 financial year has kicked in from this week. And given the inconsistency of supply, most consumers are still questioning the above inflation increase. Petrol is up at midnight. Energy commentator Hugo Kruger is first out the blocks on the program today. And Hugo, how do you believe this tariff hike then is going to impact business, particularly in terms of their monthly energy bills?
Yeah, that's right, Jeremy. But look, it was expected. The formula, as far as I know, was approved 2 years ago by NERSA. So it was expected. But, I've got sympathy for the average consumer because what do you do? You can't really escape it for most people.
So there've got to be steps put in place to try and mitigate the impact. A lot of people are talking about renewables in that respect, but it's slow and costly, isn't it?
It is, and there's a difficult conversation that is not occurring at the moment. The economists talk nowadays about what is called the missing money problem in electricity. And to explain it to people, in the past, when you had vertically integrated utilities, it was relatively simple. Everyone paid a price in kilowatt hours. Let's say you pay 6,000 rand at the end of the month. Then only 2,000 was actually for electricity. 4,000 was for transmission distribution. But now when more people go off-grid, or actually what we call grid-tied, partially off-grid, the question becomes who pays for transmission distribution if the richer folk are offsetting the full cost to the end user? Now, it's not to blame them or anything, just to explain the phenomenon. So what is currently occurring with linear tariffs at NERSA is that the bulk users are basically running away from Eskom, and then that transmission and distribution cost is being passed on to the poorest households. And how do we mitigate that? How do we find a pragmatic solution? Because you don't want to destroy the solar industry. I don't want to point fingers and say they're to blame for this, because they're not. It's a disruptive technology. And we need to come with a different way as to how we price electricity. That's my view. There are certain options on the table. I don't have a strong view which one to take. But one is what we call capacity charges, fixed tariffs. Everyone pays 400 or 600 rand a month, for example. Or times of usage tariffs, which is common in many European countries. We have a daytime rate and a nighttime rate. So when there's high usage at night, that's where Eskom tries to recover their bulk volumes. And that, to me, would be the pragmatic approach to this.
How difficult implement either of those solutions then?
Politics is the biggest obstacle. So the city of Cape Town, for example, tries this recently. They proposed, I think it was 600 rand. And the consumers of renewables tend to be their voters, right? Because it's just their voting bloc. They push back against that. So I can see that'll be difficult. The time of usage one might be a little bit easier, but the biggest obstacle, in my view, is NERSA. NERSA has to relinquish the powers to set tariffs, because they now have a market of electricity with an unbundled system. And in an unbundled system, in a free market, you don't set tariffs, you monitor tariffs. So the regulator has to understand that their new role is to monitor tariffs for uncompetitive behavior, for corruption, all of those things, collusion, but they cannot set it. And Eskom should have the power to set its own tariff, And then the municipalities must obviously cooperate with them because the municipalities under the current tariff system is forced into bankruptcy. So clearly something is not sustainable.
So how would you then change the mindset or the modus operandi as far as NERSA is concerned?
Well, this is a big question because even the Electricity Regulation Act that has been passed gives NERSA the possibility to set tariffs. So first of all, there must be a political reform. That cannot be in that act. Now, I flagged this when I went to the Portfolio Committee on Energy to oppose the unbundling. Initially, I opposed it, but I said, okay, now that's unbundled, let's go with it. So I didn't have a strong view against it. But then if we accept market conditions, you must accept the regulator can't do it. And it's more of a political mindset because it means something else, which I think is difficult for the ANC to accept. Under a market system, in a business environment, bankruptcy is part of creative destruction. So inevitably you have to accept that some guys who are in electricity trading will go bankrupt and some will win, some will lose. That's how business works. So it's part of that mindset that needs to change.
What about the risk attached to fixed tariffs?
There is a risk, which is, this is also cited in the literature. I can refer them to the work of Paul Josko at MIT, who I follow quite closely on this, who says the risk is that if you're fixed tariff, then you basically assume that transmission distribution won't have innovation to it. So do we have another clever way of funding transmission and distribution? This is the way the debate comes in. Do you have a fixed tariff or do you have a time of usage tariff? And different European countries have different solutions to it. So whichever policy decision you go with, there are risks and benefits.
Do you think that the authorities at this point are grappling with those ideas that you are raising? Or is it something which is beyond the scope at the moment?
I know of people in Eskom Transmission who they've schooled me the most on this. They don't want me to name their names because they're scared of losing their jobs sometimes. But I know that many of them have presented to the presidency themselves. Okay, so I can confirm that. So they should be aware of the situation. The issue is politics. We have an election year, and nobody wants to say to people during an election year, whether it's the business interests who fund some of the political parties or whether it is the voters, that something has to change in your tariff structure. And when that happens, somebody wins, somebody loses, right? So I think the reality will probably set in after the election. But I do know personally that the municipalities have thought of this. I've spoken to people in Pretoria. It's not a one-party thing. I've spoken to people in the ANC, and they all are aware of this, but they don't know how to sell it to the voters. So I'm being the person with giving the uncomfortable truth at the moment.
Well, let's see what happens after May 29. Hugo Kruger, thank you very much for talking to me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you'll probably be aware that the South African National Roads Agency says e-tolls will officially end on Thursday, the 11th of April, according to a government gazette signed off by the Transport Minister. The Gauteng Free Improvement Project will no longer be toll routes. One person at the front of this fight for goodness knows how long has been Outer's Wayne Duvenage, and he joins me now on the program. Wayne, first of all, before we get to the decision, how long have you been on the front lines of this fight?
Since about 2011, when still wearing my business hat, we spoke out against the schemes. All the ills that we could see arising, and that government had other avenues to pursue in financing infrastructure debt of this nature, and it had chosen the wrong decision in introducing a very cumbersome and expensive e-toll scheme. And I guess it was from those days, Jeremy, in speaking out, that one gets sucked into the real issue, which is that the people wanted to have an answer to how they were going to challenge this. Which then gave rise to the formation of ARTA, and my life changed ever since.
I'm sure it did. Ultimately, what did this cost the taxpayer for this folly?
Well, you know, essentially the big cost came in the road construction cost, which we using SANRAL's own figures in their initial estimates, put the project at costing, or should have cost, no more than 6 to 7 billion rand. And they took out bonds to the tune of 21 billion rand, 18 billion of which was the road construction costs, well overpriced. They lost control and they had very weak excuses for it, but it certainly pushed up the price of e-tolling. So it was really comes down to settling that debt. And then obviously those who'd paid over the time and shouldn't have paid, it cost them in their pockets. This is about 25% of the public throughout its duration that contributed towards the revenue. And I think that really just offset the cost of the collection process, which was set up to run the whole scheme.
So we have the roads agency saying that e-tolls will officially end on the 11th of this month. What is this going to mean for the condition and upkeep of those roads, which are vital ribbons in keeping the economy going?
Yeah, well, it shouldn't change anything, Jeremy, because just think of it this way. Prior to e-toll decision coming along, SANRAL has been managing, maintaining and building good road infrastructure, by the way, because they are good road builders, good engineers. Across the country, they run 22,000 kilometers of roads throughout the country, of which the Gauteng Freeway project upgrade of 186 is less than 1% of their total road network. So it doesn't change anything. They get funding from National Treasury, several billions every year. They get funding from their own toll network that they run themselves. And the upkeep of the three concessions is managed by those three concessions. That's the N3, TC, Bekwena, and TRAC. So nothing really changes. And all that government have introduced now about scrapping e-tolls is to fund this upgrade and its maintenance through mechanisms that they'd been using long before this upgrade happened, and which they use on many other roads, by the way. There's a whole new big freeway upgrade between Pietermaritzburg and eThekwini that is taking place, which will not be tolled. They've told us that, and that's coming from their national coffers.
Is there a physical cost and a logistics project ahead in physically closing down the system and moving, if they're going to, the gantries?
No, what they will do, and I think this is the right thing to do, is to repurpose those gantries for average speed over distance monitoring, so speed trapping and criminal looking for, crime fighting, I suppose. But the whole ETAG system is not a bad system when it is used properly. So on the long distance toll routes where there are booms, so it's not a drive now, pay later. You have to pay as you go through. The ETAG scheme allows the drive now, pay later. In other words, not drive, because you put money in your account before you get there. It'll lift the booms. And it'll also be used to allow and help people enter into parking lots and shopping malls and that, if you've got a tag. So it's going to be repurposed. Those gantries will stay there, and this tolling scheme, the electronic tolling scheme, will just be rolled out into the formal boom down plazas, as well as other mechanisms to fund itself in the long run.
Was anyone ever prosecuted for not paying?
No, there was a big attempt to do so, and thousands of summonses were sent out. The test case that was looming, with ARTA having defended or having got the mandate to defend thousands of those motorists, came to a halt in March 2019, in the lead up to those elections. It was a political decision, we believe, to stop this lawfare strategy that SANRAL had introduced over the previous few years. Ever since then, nothing really has happened. So there's been no formal legal process or prosecution against anybody who has not paid the e-toll bills.
And just finally, National Treasury is taking over 70% of the debt owed on e-tolls. Gauteng takes on the remaining 30%. That works out to something like 13 billion rand, I understand. Ultimately, that's a lot of money still. Is it just going to be written off? What do you think happens there?
We first of all can't believe that Gauteng allowed itself to be roped into settling any of this debt, because it's a National Roads Agency debt. It was National Department of Transport and Treasury that okayed this plan. It had very little to do with Gauteng. Why they allowed themselves to be roped into paying some of this debt, we don't understand. But I guess you don't want to be bite the hand that feeds you, because Gauteng province gets 85% to 90% of its revenue anyway from National Treasury. So whether it's funded directly to SANRAL from National Treasury or through Gauteng, it's neither here nor there. The worry, though, and the problem is that if Gauteng now can't finance that debt and has to go and borrow more money and get into more debt as a province, it starts to move funds away from the desperate needs of maintaining its other road networks, its hospitals, its schools, and so many other social needs that it has to meet. So it is a bad decision made on behalf of the Gauteng province.
Wayne Duvenage, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
So, as I mentioned a little earlier, up goes petrol overnight, adding to our inflation pressures. By the way, 25 Rand a litre for 95 octane. So apart from dusting off the mountain bike, are there better ways to manage your car and, I guess, make better choices at the showroom? Here now is Nicol Lowe, Car Magazine technical specialist contributor. And firstly, Nicol, how does driving behaviour then influence fuel consumption?
Okay, Jeremy, that's probably the best place to start because the driver's got the most influence in what you're going to pay at the pump next time you fill up. So if you think about fuel as energy, that's the best way to go about it. And you need to be very careful how you're going to apply this energy. So if you're going to accelerate hard, you're going to use a lot of energy. If you're going to drive high speeds, you're going to use a lot of energy. Don't forget braking as well. Harsh braking, you're basically throwing away all the energy that you use to get up to speed in the first place. So what I always say from a driver behavior point of view, treat that accelerator pedal if there's an egg underneath it. If you're going to press it too hard, it will squash the egg. That's the best way. And also anticipate. Try to see. You can rather drive at a slower speed if you can make the next traffic light to go green before you get there rather to stop. So it's all about energy conservation, and that's a way to save fuel.
But unfortunately in this country we just ignore those rules because we are impatient by nature, and I don't even need to mention the specter of road rage, for instance. So that runs counterintuitive to all the good advice. So we're going to have to pay the price, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose we're all late for meetings, all that, but it all starts with better planning. But okay, let's discuss just the other end of fuel consumption. Let's just look at your vehicle. So if you're in a situation where you can buy a new vehicle, and I know not a lot of people are in that fortunate situation, best way to look at fuel consumption is you need something that is light, something with a small engine. If you have a choice between diesel and petrol, diesel will be more fuel efficient. If you can look at a hybrid, that's maybe something to look at. So that's for new vehicles. So mass is very important because remember from the energy point of view, if you need to accelerate and brake, there's a lot of mass that you need to accelerate and brake. A lighter vehicle with a smaller engine will just use less fuel. If you're stuck with the vehicle you have, so there's no chance of going and buying a new vehicle, what can you do with your current vehicle to also improve your fuel economy? So first things first, make sure it's fully up to date with servicing because an engine that is efficient will burn less fuel. So if you never service the thing, then don't expect fuel consumption. So that's very important. Other thing is also any additional mass in the vehicle that you're driving around, your golf clubs, for example, you haven't played for the last couple of months, just take it out of the car. If we look at aerodynamic drag, anything on the outside of the car, roof racks, bicycles on the roof, roof tents, all those things that you don't use, take it off because it's just creating drag. And an interesting thing with aerodynamic drag is it increases quadratically with speed. So it's not a linear equation. So if you're driving at the national speed limit, even by going down to 100 kilometers per hour, will save you a lot of fuel. So just remember that speed is very important with aerodynamic drag. Things like air conditioning, that will cost you fuel. But remember, if you're driving at high speed, it's still better that you to use air conditioning than driving with the windows open. Then I've also always got the question from listeners as to should I use cruise control or not? So cruise control is very beneficial if you're on a level road, you want to stick to the speed limit or under the speed limit to avoid any fines. But cruise control can actually cost you a lot in fuel consumption when it's a hilly area. So remember, the cruise control will try to stick to that limit that you've preset it to. And if it's a steep uphill, it will try its utmost using maximum engine performance to get to that speed. But if you're driving it yourself, you will allow it to, say, drop a bit in speed on the uphills and then slowly increase in speed on the downhill. So cruise control in a hilly area will also cost you fuel.
I'm assuming that with the advancements in automotive technology, though, vehicles are being built better to optimize fuel efficiency.
That is correct. So obviously, fuel consumption is very important. What we see with modern vehicles is unfortunately that they're also getting heavier. So with all the safety systems, everything that goes into a vehicle these days, they're becoming heavier, but at the same time, they're trying to get in more fuel efficient. So if you look to buy a new vehicle, for example, look at the fuel consumption figures that the manufacturers state. Unfortunately, those figures are very conservative. We call it in South Africa, we get the NEDC cycle figures, which is a very conservative cycle where no auxiliaries are switched on, like aircon and lights. Acceleration is very moderate, slow speeds. But what those figures will help you with is comparison. So it doesn't give you the absolute value, but if you compare one vehicle with the next, you can see which one is more fuel efficient than the other one. So we've seen a few systems being introduced in modern vehicles to save fuel. We've seen stop-start systems, which some people find very irritating, which switch off the engine at the traffic light. So if you're in stop-start traffic and you stop a lot, then the stop-start system will actually save you a bit of fuel. We've seen things like cylinder deactivation. So if you're running a six-cylinder or eight-cylinder vehicle, sometimes it can switch off half of the cylinders to try and save fuel. Remember, the only reason is not going to use half the fuel if they switch off half the cylinders. The remaining cylinders will just work a bit harder, but also a bit more fuel efficient. So there's some technologies that's being introduced, and obviously we're seeing hybrid vehicles coming in, and then obviously all electric, which is not using any fuel.
So petrol going up at midnight tonight, and some very valuable advice for the cash-strapped consumer. Nicol Lowe from Car Magazine, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So with petrol and electricity up this month, it is becoming a lot harder for people to survive, let alone save. And I read more and more people are turning to debt counselling. So now let me bring into the conversation Bene Sager, who is executive head of Debt Busters. And Bene, firstly, last year was among the most financially difficult that South African consumers have endured since democracy. Figures from your company. From a debt perspective then, how bad is it?
I think what we've seen is the combination of the cost of living, and I would call it a crisis, by the way. I think we sometimes try to avoid it, which is driven predominantly by supply side inflation, as it becomes quite apparent to us now, with regards to fuel prices and electricity. That compounded with the persistently high interest rates really caused a lot of people to essentially have to pay more than what they had anticipated when it comes to debt and servicing debt. So I think by itself, if you isolate it, if we didn't have a cost of living crisis, if we didn't have the high inflation, again, driven by supply side, I think we would probably be in much better shape, you know, in terms of a country, in terms of being able to service the debt, even at the high and persistently high interest rates now. So how bad is it? I think if you look at the different sort of levels of debt that we see in terms of what people need as a share of their income to service the debt, for many of the income bands, we saw that to become significantly higher than what it was a year before. For example, if you look at those taking on more than 35,000 Rand per month, they needed 71% of their take-home pay to basically service their debt. For those taking home less than 5,000 Rand, which is on the other end of the spectrum, they needed 66% of their take-home pay to essentially service their debt. And we may ask ourselves, why is it the case? Because at the bottom end, the debt levels are not that high. The issue is the escalation in terms of the interest rates. And, you know, when we compare average interest rates, if you go back, let's go back 5 years. At the end of 2019, the average interest rate was reasonably high at 23.8% for unsecured debt. At the end of 2023, it was actually 25.6% per annum. It's even higher than what we would consider to be high. And I think what we've also seen on the other end is that the cost in terms of interest rate, in terms of servicing asset-based stuff, particularly the vehicle finance, has gone from something like 12% to 15.6% per annum.
Right.
And most of this would have been essentially credit that people would have signed up to when the interest rates were much lower during most of 2020 and 2021.
Be that as it may, though, what this also indicates to me is that we're not very good as a nation in financial planning. And secondly, we simply don't take debt seriously enough.
I think we have a love and hate relationship with credit. We love it because it gives us opportunities to do things that we couldn't do before, particularly given our history as a nation. And it's quite important to keep that in context. But what we've seen in the last few years is I think people are more cognizant of what happens when you overextend yourself in terms of credit. But what we've seen over the last few years is actually access to credit has become the real reason for most people that they can put food on the table. I mean, you've agreed many anecdotal evidence and some other research. This is not my area of expertise, but I've heard some people say, from the surveys, a lot of them, 60% of the population say they're skipping a meal to make sure that they have enough money to cater for their kids and so on. And I think the inflation is really what's pushed us. And I think we're seeing the other impact of it. But I do want to take a minute to talk about the vehicle financing, because I think, having spent 10 years now in this industry, I think the vehicle financing is the number one culprit when it comes to pushing us over the edge. And I think we should realize that vehicles are very expensive in South Africa. If you want to finance them, they become even more expensive. But given the difficulty in terms of our public transport or lack thereof, there aren't essentially many other avenues for people to be able to go
and
to work.
Ben, I'll accept that argument to a point, and you're absolutely right. However, so many people buy beyond what they can afford, and they end up paying the price when the vehicle is repossessed.
Exactly, which is the point that I was getting to. I think we don't understand when we sign up to vehicle finance agreements, we don't understand things like balloon payment. We don't understand the extras. We don't understand. We don't take the time to understand, I would say, in terms of what is going to really cost us. And at the end of the 4 years, when that agreement is finished, what do we have in our hands to show? And I think we don't quite comprehend all the other costs that come with it, which is exactly the point that you're making. And I think that is the single thing that I've seen tip people over the edge. Often is the case that they would sign up to a vehicle that they shouldn't be. But at the same time, even the lowest end vehicles are still costing somewhere between 180 to 250,000 rand before you include financing. And I think it's become simply beyond the reach of many individuals. So I would really caution people to think twice before signing up to vehicle finance agreements. It might take them beyond their means.
Let me ask you in conclusion a quick question about debt counseling, if I can. And given the rapid changes that you've outlined for me in the economic landscape, sudden increases in essential costs like petrol and electricity, which we're dealing with today, how adaptable these days are debt counseling strategies to make sure that they do remain relevant and effective?
Debt counseling is a regulated industry, and I think, you know, the everything that comes with it is either part of the National Credit Act or the regulations thereof. So I think, you know, what one needs to consider is that it's a long-term process. It takes, for most of our consumers to complete, somewhere between 4 to 5 years. The reality is we don't know what the world looks like in 4 to 5 years. So we have to have that hat on. You know, when we sign up to something like that, we have to assume that things will change. We just don't know which way. For example, in terms of the adaptability, many of the consumers who signed on during 2020 when interest rates are low, and those consumers who had in terms of assets, their interest rates also go up as the interest rate goes up in terms of their assets. That could not have been foreseen. At least I did not foresee that the interest rates would go up by 475 basis points. Now, that was 4 years ago in terms of if you think about 2020. In the next 4 years, the people who sign up today, what if the interest rates go down by 475 basis points? I'm not saying that will happen, but then that provides immense relief to the consumers.
Right.
The reality is that it's difficult to know. But I would say think of debt counseling as a long-term strategy. It should never be part of your short-term strategy to claw back in terms of your cash flow and your debt repayments. But keep in mind that during the 4 to 5 years, there will be some things that will be different. We just don't know necessarily what they are.
I'm going to leave it there. Ben Asega, thank you very much indeed. And just to remind you then of those numbers, inland, the price of 93-octane petrol is up by 65 cents a litre, and 95 up by 67 cents a litre. And slightly better news if you live on the coast, 93 is increased by 58 cents a litre, and 95-octane goes up by 60 cents a litre. And all of that from 1 o'clock tomorrow morning. Just before I bid you farewell, on our online poll Thursday last week, we asked you after an extensive interview with the electricity minister whether you had confidence in the work that he's doing, and over 80% of our respondents gave him a flat thumbs down. On our poll today, we interviewed on this a little earlier about the final scrapping of e-tolls, and I'd like your view on that. Were they always a folly? Do you think that road maintenance is going to be compromised, or ultimately are we still going to end up paying? If you have a view on that, please get in touch with us either via Twitter X or on our LinkedIn page. Hit the poll, and I will bring you the results on the show tomorrow. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. As always, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.